This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is author Rowan Jacobson, who writes about food, the environment, and the connection between the two. His work has appeared in The Art of Eating, The New York Times, Wild Earth, and elsewhere. He is the author of A Geography of Oysters, which won a James Beard Foundation Award. Rowan Jacobson is here today to discuss his recent book, Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis, published in 2008 by Bloomsbury USA. Welcome, Rowan.
Hi, Dan.
What led you to write your book, Fruitless Fall?
Well, you know, it all started maybe 3 years ago. A friend of mine who had kept bees in San Francisco was visiting me in Vermont. I live in the country out in Vermont, and there's a couple of acres of meadows around my house, and my friend looked around at these meadows and the southern exposure and said, wow, you know, this would be a perfect spot for bees. And I thought that sounded pretty neat. I'd always been interested in bees. So we ordered a couple of hives. And what you do when you order honeybee hives is you place a deposit in the fall and then you pick them up in the spring. So we placed our deposits. But then in the winter, the beekeeper sent an email to all his clients saying, sorry, no bees this year. They all died. And I thought, wow, that's strange. And so then I really started paying attention. And it was shortly after that that we started hearing all these reports in the media about collapsing colonies all over the country. And that was when I really started to dig in and do more research and follow the story. And the more research I did, the more scared I got about what this means for our whole agricultural supply. So that was the impetus for the book.
To what extent does the food we eat depend on bees and their ability to pollinate?
Bees pollinate more than 100 of the food crops that we eat, most of the crops. And what that means is that they have to take pollen from one flower on a plant to another flower on a plant. And only when that cross-pollination happens will the plant grow seeds and fruit around the seeds. And so that means that most of the fruits we eat require bees or some other insects to do this cross-pollination. And that includes vegetables we eat that are actually fruits, like zucchinis and cucumbers. So you're talking about almonds, apples, blueberries, almost all berries, actually, zucchini, avocado, cucumber, pumpkin, squash. About 35% of our calories are totally dependent on bees.
Could you give a specific example, too, with the almond trees and talk specifically about them?
Almonds are the crop that is most dependent on bees, and part of the reason for that is that they are grown in vast monocrops in California's Central Valley. That's where 82% of the world's almonds come from. It's about 700,000 acres of almond trees right now. And every almond must be made by a bee. Every almond flower turns into one almond. So the almond growers don't have any wild insects in those hundreds of thousands of acres of almond trees. Nothing is living in there except the almond trees and a little bit of grass. So they pay commercial beekeepers to truck hives into the almond orchards during the bloom in February. And they need about 2 hives per acre. So that means about 1.5 million hives are required to set the new almond crop. And that's about as many hives as we have left in the entire country right now.
Why were honeybees originally chosen for agricultural purposes? What are their special traits?
Their special traits are that they play nice with people, right? There are about 4,000 species of native bees in the United States, and they're all good pollinators, but they're all living out in wild areas, and they don't tend to live in hives of 40 or 50,000 individuals like honeybees do. And that's really been the key for this partnership between humans and honeybees that goes back to even before the beginnings of agriculture. So lots of pollinators will do the job, but only honeybees come in convenient boxes of 50,000 and can be loaded onto trucks and carried around to where the crops are.
Would you comment on the history of beekeeping and how it has changed over time?
Well, right from the beginning of agriculture, and even before, humans were honey hunters, right? That was the first attraction for us. And probably we didn't realize the basics of pollination until pretty late in the game. In fact, as late as 1929, believe it or not, the state of Utah had passed a law banning honeybees from the state because they believed that honeybees sapped the vitality of plants. They had it totally backward. That's 1929. But what happened is throughout human history, we had honeybees around for the honey, right? Every farm would have a hive or two, and unwittingly, we were letting those hives take care of a lot of the pollination needs of our crops. So really, human agriculture has developed in step with the honeybee all along.
How did beekeeping transition from being focused on honey production to being focused on pollination?
That's an excellent question. Yeah, you know, when you think about a beekeeper, you think somebody whose business is making honey. And that used to be true. But in the past few decades, what has happened is that the world price of honey has plunged because of competition from China. China's kind of flooded the market with very cheap honey. And that has meant that in recent decades, beekeepers can't actually make a profit making honey. They would lose money. The cost of production is higher than the cost they can sell their honey for. Fortunately for them, at that same time, we started hitting a point where fertility was at a premium, right? Pollination became very important to farmers, and they couldn't get it naturally anymore because too many wild areas had been wiped out. So that's when they started paying pretty decent prices to beekeepers to get the hives into their crop. So beekeepers kind of switched their business. You know, if it was up to them, they would just stay home and make honey. But then they began taking pollination contracts, and then that quickly became more lucrative for them than honey could be. But then to stay in business, they kept having to go farther and farther afield. And that's why now we have kind of this migratory bee industry where a commercial beekeeper will pollinate almonds in California in February, then come up to Washington State to do apples, then go over to the Dakotas to do canola and sunflowers in May, then over to Maine for blueberries in June, down to Pennsylvania for pumpkins in July, and then maybe go to Florida for the winter where there's other wild things blooming for the bees to eat and prepare for almonds again. So our honeybees are covering tens of thousands of miles on the backs of trucks every year.
In Europe, is there the same issue with lots of moving honeybees around?
Migratory beekeeping goes back to, you know, the ancient Egyptians would load hives on barges on the Nile and go up and down the Nile following the bloom. And so Europeans do practice a little bit of migratory beekeeping, but the distances are much shorter and it's usually localized. It's only in America have we come up with this system of vast monocrops and highly migratory honeybees.
Would you describe the social structure of bees?
Yeah, they are really fascinating creatures. They've developed a fully social style of life like few other creatures. We happen to be one of them, but there's this amazing division of labor in the hive where when a bee hatches, it gets assigned some basic tasks like cleaning and maybe nursery, like daycare, right? Caring for the larvae that are being grown. And then basically, you know, they keep looking for better jobs and getting them as they grow up, just like we do. They might get assigned to build some honeycomb, and then they become receiver bees who wait at the edge of the hive. And when the foraging bees, who are the oldest bees, come back with a full load of nectar that they've gathered from flowers, they unload it into the receiver bees, kind of like tanker trucks, and then they go out for another mission. Then after about 3 weeks of that in-hive work, the young bees finally get their wings and they're allowed to fly on their own. So they go out from the hive and they do some orientation flights to get their bearings, and then they head off to find flowers and bring nectar and pollen back to the hive. And the funny thing is a colony of bees is really more like a super organism than a collection of individuals, because out of those 40 or 50,000 bees, only one can reproduce, the queen. So everybody's, you know, genetic eggs are in that one basket, right? So it's all for one and one for all. Their whole purpose is to keep the queen happy and healthy and laying 1,000 to 2,000 eggs a day. That's the only way that they can pass their genes on, is it because they're, you know, they're the daughters of the queen, so they've got to keep her going. That's why, you know, bees, when they sting, they die. But that doesn't really matter to the hive because they're almost like individual cells in a superorganism.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Rowan Jacobson, author of the book Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. You've been alluding to this, but in what ways have bees and humans benefited each other? Could you underscore that?
Well, as far as bees are concerned, we've been good for them because they evolved in Africa, right? And then they slowly migrated up to Europe. This is the European honeybee we're talking about. And normally in the wild, they would look for hollow trees to make their hives. But it's been this great case of coevolution where we were getting something good from the bees, honey originally, right? And so we began building these boxes to keep the bees. But if you look at it from the bees' perspective, what we've done is provide them with an unbelievable amount of habitat all around the world and transportation all around the world. So we've helped the bee expand to cover every continent other than Antarctica. And in return, we've received honey and a whole lot of pollination from the bee.
So now the bees are starting to die, as you mentioned at the beginning, that you had noticed when you ordered some and then they were dead. Would you describe colony collapse disorder?
Yeah, this is a syndrome, and right now we call it a syndrome, which basically means we don't know what it is. We just know what the symptoms are. It's the syndrome that first surfaced in the fall of 2006 when commercial beekeepers started just noticing perfectly healthy hives that within the space of maybe 2 weeks would completely collapse and depopulate. All the adult bees would simply disappear. They would head out one day and not come back. And this dwindling over a period of a couple of weeks would leave the hive dead. And it happened, some beekeepers experienced losses of 50% of their hives. Some beekeepers even experienced losses of 90% of their hives. They were basically ruined. Some beekeepers went out of business because of it. And the estimates are about 31% of the honeybee colonies in the United States died over that fall and winter. And then what happens with honeybees is they have this seasonal lifestyle where fall and winter are always hard for them. And then spring, flowers bloom, and life gets easier. So about 31% died. And then during the spring and summer of 2007, they stabilized. And everyone hoped that whatever the problem was, it was over. But then last fall and winter, again, the problem resurfaced and actually became slightly worse. And another 37% of the remaining bees died. So researchers have been trying to figure out what's going on. And they have a few culprits that they're looking at. But so far, they haven't been able to find a smoking gun.
How widespread geographically is this colony collapse disorder? I believe in the book you mentioned it was happening outside the United States as well.
Yes. Honeybees are collapsing pretty much all around the world, and there's a variety of causes for that. We're still trying to define colony collapse disorder, exactly what it is. But right now, all we know is that suddenly a healthy hive, all the adults will disappear within a span of just 2 or 3 weeks. So that's the definition of colony collapse disorder right now. So there could be multiple things contributing to that. But what we know is that the United States is maybe suffering the worst, but all of Europe is badly hit too. And Asia, it's harder to get numbers out of Asia, but there are lots of reports of problems.
Would you say more about what is known about the causes? It's not known, but could you say the research that's been done and what we've come to know?
Most of the beekeepers I have spoken with believe that a new class of pesticides is what's behind this. About 10 years ago, there was kind of a revolution in the pesticide world. These new pesticides called the neonicotinoids sort of took over the market. They're now the most popular, best-selling pesticides in the world. And they act differently than the older generations. When we think of pesticides, you think you spray it on the crop, then rain comes, washes them off, you have to respray. These new pesticides are systemic, which means you just coat the seeds with the pesticide, and then as the plant grows, the pesticide manifests itself throughout the plant. This is great for farmers because they don't have to worry about the pesticide being washed off. Not so great for bees who have to get their food from the plant because small bits of the pesticide show up in the nectar and pollen. And we know that this type of insecticide, it's used a lot for termite control. And when you use it on termites, what happens is it's a nerve disruptor, neuron disruptor. So the messages going from the brain to the rest of the body get screwed up. And what you get is immune system collapse, disorientation, memory loss. Basically, you kind of get the equivalent of advanced Alzheimer's disease. And that is exactly what we're seeing in the bees that remain in these hives have collapsed. And it was introduced and used in a large scale in this country right about the time that bees started collapsing. So there was a lot of tantalizing bits of evidence there. And the beekeepers I know all believe that this is what it is. They bring their hives into a crop that's used this insecticide, and then the bees slowly start to manifest these symptoms of dementia, really. But when France actually banned this class of pesticides back in 2000 because they believed it was killing their honeybees, and France's bees haven't really recovered since it was banned, their beekeepers say that it's because the pesticide is still in the soil. No one's really sure. But anyway, the evidence that the researchers have looked at doesn't look that strong for this pesticide being the culprit. But everyone's still watching it very closely just because it fits in so many different ways. Then there's a new virus that has surfaced in the United States that was recently found in honeybees called Israeli acute paralysis virus. And this is the one the researchers are probably looking at the most carefully. Some believe that it was introduced from Australia a few years ago. The United States, since the 1920s, had a ban on importing honeybees so that we wouldn't bring in any new diseases. But then the bee problems had gotten bad enough in 2005. The almond growers needed so many bees that we waived that law and began airlifting jumbo jets full of bees from Australia to help out the almond growers. And this was about when this virus first appeared and colon collapse disorder started happening. So some believe that it was imported from Australia because bees that were tested coming in from Australia had the virus. But Australia's bees are doing great, so that doesn't quite fit there. And then when researchers went back and looked at some bees that had been frozen in labs back to the 2002, they found the virus in those bees as well, which was before the Australian bees were imported. So that picture's a little murky too. The other thing that people are looking at is really more just of a lifestyle issue. We've talked about the migratory lifestyle that most bees lead now, and bees are like us. They need a mixed diet of lots of different flowers so they can get their full nutrient needs. They need a low stress level if they're to flourish, and that's not what bees have anymore. Besides being, you know, trapped on the backs of semis for a fair amount of their lives, when they're in between crops, they get unloaded into lots and there's nothing for them to eat. So beekeepers take jars of high fructose corn syrup and throw those on top of all the hives, and that's what the honeybees eat. And it turns out that high fructose corn syrup isn't any better for them than it is for us, and that reduces their lifespan. So there's a lot of factors that seem to be reducing honeybees' lifespan to what it should be.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Rowan Jacobson, author of the book Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis. What have been some of the attempts to either prevent or deal with colony collapse disorder?
Well, you know, it's kind of like dealing with the flu in human populations. Since they have no idea how to cure it, the advice so far is have some chicken soup and get your rest. Basically, keep the bees' strength up. So beekeepers are trying to improve the diets of the bees. They give them these protein patties to supplement their protein needs. And beekeepers who can are keeping their bees away from areas that they know have been hit with these neonicotinoids. But that is about all that anyone can do at this point. Less mixing of bees would probably be good, because obviously if you bring every beehive in the country into California during almond season for kind of like, you know, a giant bee convention, it's like kindergarten, right? Like they all come home with colds, right? They mix. And so that's a great way to spread a virus around if the virus is the answer. So isolating bees is one way that you can hopefully stay away from what is happening. But the problem is we don't really know what's causing this. So there's a lot of theories out there. And Congress just finally allocated some money to study colony collapse disorder, but it'll be a few years before we get anything solid out of that.
How close are we to not having enough bees to pollinate our crops?
Well, watch almonds in this February very carefully. A lot of people I talked to believe that there probably were not enough bees to cover the need last February if we had had bad weather for the almonds. What growers try to do is they try to supersaturate their orchards with bees, because if they get bad weather and the bees can't fly, then what they need, like the shock and awe of a massive bee air force to handle all the pollination in little short windows of good weather. Bees won't fly if it's rainy or if it's below maybe 55 degrees. But last February, they got perfect weather. So a reduced bee air force was able to cover all the almond orchards. But this February, we could have an even more reduced air force. And if they get a few storms, if there's only very short windows to do the pollination, then there may well not be the need, which would mean a much smaller almond crop than we've had before, which would mean much higher almond prices than we've had. So almonds would be the canary in the coal mine, the first one to go down. Other crops need less bees, but the trend would probably be the same with lower yields and rising prices.
Is there a fix for that problem?
Well, one thing that's starting to happen is everyone's going, hey, we shouldn't have put all our eggs in this one basket. Let's have a more diverse supply of pollinators on hand. So they're looking at some other insects that might supply some pollination needs. The current estimates are that managed honeybees are responsible for about $15 billion a year of our produce, but wild insects are responsible for about $3 billion worth of pollination. So they do contribute about a sixth and could contribute more. Most organic farms that are anywhere near a wild area get all their pollination from wild insects. So the way to sort of have a more resilient system of agriculture would be to move toward smaller farms within shot of wild areas that can serve as, you know, insect motels, basically.
What do we know about the health of the wild pollinators?
Shockingly, nothing, practically. Nobody has looked at this because the research follows the funding, right? And nobody was funding studies of wild insects because nobody cared about wild insects. But now the alarm has been raised and we're realizing the incredible importance of these wild pollinators, not just for the foods we eat, but for pretty much every ecosystem you see out there. 3/4 of the plants on Earth require pollination in order to reproduce. So we don't even have the baselines of studies showing the populations of these various insects we used to have. So the first step is we're trying to get those baselines now so we can see which direction they're going in. Europe has been doing a better job of monitoring their wild pollinators. They have about 30 years of data. And it seems to show that about a third of those wild species are in decline. And we know we've lost at least several species of bumblebees in the U.S. in the past decade or so. So the little bits of information we do have are not good, but we really don't know at this point.
What is our world likely to be like if bees largely disappear?
Well, some people may have seen a NOVA special that I think it aired last year, which gave us a little glimpse into what the world may hold for us. It showed the pear orchards in China, which are kind of the equivalent of the almonds in California, hundreds of thousands of acres of pear orchards in rural China. But because of over-exuberant use of pesticides in those areas, they've killed all insect life. So there's nothing to pollinate those pears, and the mobile beekeepers in China aren't about to bring their bees anywhere near these orchards. But China being China, they've come up with a different solution, which is to use human bees. So during the pear bloom, thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even millions of villagers climb through the trees with what they call pollination sticks in hand, which are made of chicken feathers and sometimes cigarette filters, dipping them in pollen and touching the pollination sticks to every single flower on every single tree so that it will set fruit. And it works, but it requires an incredible human effort. And it's like one of the most apocalyptic things I've ever seen. So hopefully that is not the direction we're going down.
Given the research you've done for your book, what's your prediction about what will happen?
Well, you know, I think there are some good trends that we're moving toward a more sustainable system of agriculture. But you're going to see higher food prices as yields go down, and we can't guarantee full pollination for some of these crops. But of course, you're seeing higher food prices already, and there's so many factors happening. And we've kind of got so many emergencies right now that it's hard to get the emergencies in line and prioritize them. But I think yields are in trouble.
What can individuals do to help bees?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. That's a great question. Because we can all help. And maybe the most important thing would be to not use any type of insecticides or pesticides. When we use them on lawns and bees visit our flowers, they pick up those pesticides. Golf courses use a ton of pesticides, including neonicotinoids. So if you play golf, you could encourage the golf course to shift away from them. But also right in our backyards, one great thing we can do is to plant native species of plants, because if a plant is native to your area, that means a flowering plant. That means it evolved with whatever insects are native, and it's probably good food for them because it's been using them to help it reproduce for, you know, a million years. So visiting nurseries and working with the native plants that they supply is a great way that we can all give bees kind of little refugia of good food stops.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Think about the world from the insect point of view every now and then. That's one thing that changed for me while I was doing research on this book is, you know, I'll never see flowers the same again now. That to me, they're not ornamentation anymore. They're food, you know, beautiful food. And stopping the war on bugs. You know, we kind of think of bugs as the enemy, but we are completely dependent on them.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Rowan.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
We have just been speaking with Rowan Jacobson, author of the book Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis, published in 2008 by Bloomsbury USA. For more information, check on the web at www.rowanjacobson.com. Again, that's rowanjacobsen.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.